Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Final Descend podcast. I'm your host, Wes Calvert. Today with me, I have a guy from Montana by the name of Garrett Backman. Garrett was on the last episode for a short little bit with us and talked a little turkey hunting and stuff like that. So I figured I'd bring him back for a full episode so everybody could hear about the great state of Montana. Garrett, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Doing good, doing good. The sun finally came out, so it looks like it's going to be a nice day here in mid-Missouri. It's supposed to be about 50 degrees, so nice and warm for February.
Yeah, passed it up here. And we were in the negatives for the past couple days, so I'm glad we're finally going to be out of negative today for one. For a while, hopefully.
Yeah, once I get past duck season and goose hunting and stuff, I'm really just over the cold weather and just ready for it to warm up, so...
Yeah, I like it when it hangs around like the 20s so I can go ice fishing in a sweatshirt. That's all I care about.
Yeah, yeah. So that's one thing we don't get to do a whole lot of around here. We don't get to do a lot of ice fishing. It doesn't stay cold that long. So we'll get a span where it stays below freezing for a week or so, but just not enough to get the ice thick enough to where we can really get on it and do ice fishing. So that's something I've always wanted to try, though.
Yeah, we went spear fishing 2 weekends ago, and we had 34 inches of ice, I think it was,
on the pond that we were on.
It's still pretty thick.
Yeah, that's a lot of ice. So I see people that like to drive their vehicles and stuff like that on the ice. How thick does the ice have to be able to drive your truck on it?
We don't drive our truck on the ice unless we see another truck on the ice.
That's a good gauge.
They say around 16 to 18 to be safe. It says 12 inches for a small vehicle, but we like this about 2 foot, 18 inches, somewhere in there, just to be safe. But I don't want to be the dummy that gets a picture of his pickup posted all over Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah, falling through the ice. That'd be a predicament. I've always wondered in those videos how they end up getting those trucks out of there.
Well, it depends on. Sometimes if they didn't sink in very deep, they can get a chain on it, get a couple of vehicles in a line and pull it out. But, if it's like ice is going out, we're getting thin ice and going into spring, a lot of times they just have to wait and then get an underwater wrecker to come in and crane it out.
Oh, wow. That's
what we do on Fort Peck anyway.
And that can't be cheap either. So I could only imagine what that insurance claim is like.
Yeah, there's a couple snowmobiles and side-by-sides and four-wheelers that's not even worth the cost of it to pull it out, so they just sit in the bottom.
They just leave it there? Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive. So, Garrett, whereabouts in Montana are you located?
I am in the northeast corner. I guess the town I went to high school in, we were 12 miles from the Canadian border and 40 from North Dakota, but now I'm about 40 miles from the North Dakota border and 40 miles from Canada.
Okay.
And we moved off a little bit.
So you can scoot on over to North Dakota in no time, and you're not too far from Canada either, so you're up there.
Oh, yeah.
So
right on the Missouri River.
Right on the Missouri River. We are on the Missouri River as well, but we're on a different, I'm sure the Missouri River here looks a lot different than what it looks like up there.
Yeah, I've seen your guys. It looks like a lot faster moving and a lot dirtier by the time it gets to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's muddy. I guess that's why they call it the Big Muddy.
Big Muddy, yeah.
And it's fast running river, very big river. So it's can get you into some predicaments if you don't respect it, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So what do you like to hunt? What is your animal of choice in Montana? What do you like to chase? Big game? Do you like to chase waterfowl, upland? What do you like to get after?
Well, I started out big game. I didn't really grow up in a bird house. I mean, like once or twice we went waterfowl hunting when I was really little, and that was just laying out next to a slough. Or we'd go pheasant hunting every now and again because my family was from South Dakota, so we have to pheasant hunt. But mostly we were big game. All my memories of hunting really are going out chasing antelope in South Dakota. Me and my dad went to the Black Hills when I was a kid and hunted elk when he drew an archery tag there, and then deer hunting nonstop. And so I grew up doing the big game thing and just kind of upland here and there. And when I got to college, my cousin was all ate up with waterfowl hunting, and he was a little bit younger than me. And so he drugged me along, and I did a couple hunts in the early North Dakota season when it was August and it was 105 degrees and we were sweating our dick off and terrible mosquitoes and humidity and didn't get a single goose. And I thought it was the dumbest thing ever. And then like the fourth trip, we finally went out there with a couple guys and we pounded out, I think it was 3 15 bird limits. And wow. Then I kind of sunk in, and all the shitty hunts lead up to one. I mean, that's just kind of the antithesis of waterfowl hunting, is you get one banger and then you got to suffer through a bunch more to make up for that.
Yeah, that's for sure. You get a lot of sucky ass hunts to get a couple good ones, but I'll take those bad ones just for the good ones, just because they're just so fun and there's nothing like it. So
yeah.
So in Montana, do you have to draw for your resident tags, or do they have a certain number allotted for you, whatever you decide to chase, whether it be elk or antelope or anything like that? So
it depends on what you're wanting. You can get your general deer tag or your general elk tag, but those are only good for general regions, which is pretty much where for elk, it's where there's not a huge number of elk. Like, you might just stumble across one. If you want to do specific, like, elk-heavy areas, they've got a lot of tags you got to put in for the drawing for. Like, if you want to go to, like, the big snowies and stuff like that, you'd have to apply for the tag, so it's not guaranteed. But we're guaranteed our general elk tag, and then our general deer tag is good everywhere except for, like, certain areas or the reservations. And then you can, I think your 2B tags, you're allowed, which are doe tags, and then you can apply for more doe tags, but most of the time they just end up being surplus tags, so you can just go in and buy extra ones when you want them.
Okay.
But yeah, if you're just regular deer hunting and don't want to go anywhere special, you just walk in the store, buy your, I think it's $8.50 for a tag, and go
hunt. Wow. That's cheap. So we we can do that. So we buy our deer tags over the counter as well, and they're, if I remember, it's been a couple of years since I've bought a deer tag, but you get any deer tag, I think it's for like $20, and then if you want to buy an antlerless tag, it's another $7. So $27 for two tags is kind of what we pay, and then same for like spring turkey hunting, it's $17, if I remember, 17 or 19, something like that. But you get two tags for that, so it's not bad. But the big game out west has always kind of intrigued me. I've never really put much thought into it, but excuse me, had some buddies talk me into putting in for Wyoming. We put in for antelope, and I think we put in for antelope, mule deer, and elk as well. So of course it'd be several years before we would be able to draw an elk tag, but I think we're kind of shooting for antelope because we want to just try to get out there and get our feet wet. So
yeah, that's a good way to start, especially if you're going to go rifle. It's a good way to start. Antelope is nice and easy. It's not like it's a morning and evening thing, it's all day. You can go out and spot them and try to stock up on them.
Yeah, that's, and getting out there, that's going to be a big learning curve too. I mean, we don't do a whole lot of, I mean, I guess you could do spot and stalk around here with deer, but a lot of it's sitting in a tree stand and, you know, figuring patterns and stuff like that. So that's going to be a big learning curve, but I'm pretty excited to, if we get the chance to go out there this fall to, see what it's like and, kind of try our hand at it per se.
Yeah. I mean, it'll be fun. It always is. It's hunting. So
yeah. You're hunting and you're not at work. Better. So that's a plus.
Yeah. Especially like if you're a new country, everything's like, I guess I wouldn't say like a dream, but it's just different. Like there's different feeling to it when you're somewhere new, seeing new country and then chasing something you never chased before. It's all like, it's like you're a kid, you're all giddy about it no matter what happened.
Oh yeah, definitely. So do you do any fishing out there? What type of fishing do you like to do? I knew obviously we were talking about ice fishing there, but what fish do you chase during the summer?
So a lot of what we have here is just like, we have the Poplar River that went through Scobie where I went to high school. And then that comes down to the Missouri, and there's really not much, like, we don't have ponds and lakes and like stuff like you guys have, or like in North Dakota or Minnesota. So we pretty much just get whatever is in the river. Or if we're lucky, there might be like a stock dam. But so it's mostly pike is the big thing. Lots of pike. You might luck into a walleye here and there. That's just if you're like your bankfish in the river. Or catfish too. If we go in Missouri and we go in the boat, we go catfishing. And then, yeah, try to get walleye, try to get pike. If we get a trip to Fort Peck, we'll go snag over on Fort Peck during snagging season, or we'll go walleye fishing that. But in the wintertime, a lot of what we do is we'll go to like dams and ponds and stuff where we know that there's pike, and most of the time those are pretty clear, so then we spearfish them. So in the wintertime, that's what we do a lot of, is we spear pike.
Spearfishing?
Yep.
That's something that's pretty. So are you using like the little fish decoy that, you know, I see on, yep. I see TikTok videos, they got the little fish decoy down there and someone's, you know, maybe just leaving, you know, whatever it does. And you see him, you know, stab the fish from over above in a big old hole. So
yeah, that's exactly it.
So how long does it take you to cut one of those big, you know, how big of a rectangle are you cutting whenever you're cutting open a nice hole, and how long does it take?
It depends on, I guess, who you're with, so what tools you have, because there's a big ice saw, like it's like a 36-inch blade, and mm-hmm. it folds up like a giant jackknife and folds down. If you have one of those, you pop your four corner hole, and it'll be, so like we're using a 10-inch auger, usually you, if you're going to do it without the saw, start that way. You start on one corner, you drill your hole, and then you touch your auger right next to it, so they're just touching, so they're connected, and you drill another one, and you do that, so it'll be one, two, three, four going across, and then two more down, and then four back across, so it's 4x3 holes.
Yeah.
So 10 inches, so that would be, I guess, 40 inches by 30 inches or whatever, a rectangle. But if you have a saw, you just drill your four corner holes, just kind of, I mean, you've done enough time to, you know what kind of size it's supposed to look like. You'll drill your four corner holes, and then you use the saw just to connect those, like to connect the dot. And that's quicker, but it's a lot more work to do it, but then you don't have to, there's a lot less slush you have to clean out afterwards. I mean, if you got a good sharp saw, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you can have it cut, ice block out, and I mean, just cleaning the most of the slush out, and then once you get the tent over, you just get the rest of the little bit of slush out once you get it over there.
Okay. That's not too bad then. I was like, man, it seems like you'd spend a lot of time, because I know, like, when we're breaking ice and stuff for duck hunting, it's like, man, it's kind of the worst part of the deal. You know, you're out there breaking ice for, you know, whatever it is, 45 minutes to an hour. Of course, you're breaking a little bigger hole than what you're doing if you're ice fishing. But yeah, I'm sure those tools make pretty quick work of it. So,
well, and it's nice too if you got a couple guys that know what they're doing, because you can have two guys or whatever, a guy setting up the tent and then two guys doing the hole itself. So you can take turns doing it. Like when you're doing that saw, it wears you out. But if you're just doing it by yourself, you're taking breaks and stuff. You just go until you're tired hand, it's the next guy, and he goes until he's tired. I mean, it doesn't take much to do it. But if you're just by yourself, I mean, it's a lot bigger job. It'll take longer.
Yeah.
I don't really like going by myself anyway. It's just that big of a hole. I mean, one flip on the ice, you're down in that water, and you're by yourself in the middle of nowhere. You're kind of screwed.
Yeah. Yeah, you would be screwed. So, yeah, that's something that's always intrigued me, too, is the spearfishing. Do you guys get any of the, like, do you guys have sturgeon up in that area? I know I see people sturgeon spearfish and stuff. Do you do any of that, or are those any, you know, are those around in your area?
Well, they got sturgeon in Fort Peck in the dam. And I guess there is like little ones that are in the Missouri here, but I've never caught one. But you can't spear those here. Like Wisconsin, they can. And I think Michigan, they can, but don't quote me on that. Don't have somebody call me and get pissed off, but I think those two states you can, but we can't do that here.
Yeah,
it'd be cool. I'd love to. But
when's your snagging season opening for paddlefish?
I don't know the exact date, but it's in the spring, like spring rolling into summer.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's the same with ours. Our snagging season is, it rolls, so we get 45 days, I believe it is, 15 days in March, and then 30 days in April, something like that. So yeah, we get about a 45 day season, because it runs March 15th through the end of April. And so we've done that a lot in the past. We're kind of getting out of it a little bit. It just, the gas to get back and forth and gas in the boat and everything, and just the cost of it is kind of has kind of gotten to the way. What's that?
You guys are snagging from the boat?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, so we snag on the Lake of the Ozarks. So it's basically a, you know, it's a lake, but it, you know, at the point that we're snagging, it's basically just a giant river channel. So we run up and, you know, run up and down the river channel and in the boat and snag. So we use a deal that they call it's called a dipsy diver, and it's basically a disc that's probably about this big around, and you put it on the end of the, you know, it replaces the weight on the end of the line, and then you've got your three hooks going up, and so you set them in a rod holder, and basically you're just trolling. And that dipsy diver holds the hooks on the bottom. You know, you're driving at about 5 mile an hour, and then you set your bait clickers and stuff. So whenever you hit the fish, you're woo. So
it's like a giant bottom bouncer. Like,
yeah,
for walleye, a little bit different.
That's basically what it is, because I think that's kind of where that idea originated. Was they use those a lot up on the Great Lakes. When they're trolling on the Great Lakes. So, but it's it made the sport a lot easier, that's for sure, because before that idea was kind of discovered, or, you know, people started using them in that fashion, you know, we would basically, you're snagging just like you're doing from the bank. You're just standing on the back of the boat and you're sitting there just pulling on your pole all day, you know. Let it hit the bottom, pull up, let it hit the bottom, pull up, let it hit the bottom, pull up. And that, yeah, those days are past me. I'm not out there to be yanking on a pole all day. You know, you're just dog tired at the end of the day.
Makes those beers taste that much better though.
It does. It's kind of, there's kind of a debate going around with the dipsy divers and the sport of snagging, because before, you know, there was always several fish caught before, just with the traditional snagging, but with the dipsy divers, you can cover a lot more ground in a shorter amount of time, so it made it more efficient, and people are catching more fish. So it's one of those deals where people are like, wow, those dipsy divers, they're cheating. You know, there's no skill in that. You're just driving. And I'm like, well, you still got to be able to read your graph. You know, you still got to be able to find the fish, you know? So it's,
so that was something that I think it was when we were talking about, deer hunting, how like they factor in that for like a waterfowl, one of them. Anyways, they factor in the amount of times that you're going to go out and get nothing, or half your limit, or one instead of your full. Well, when you get yourself so much more efficient where you're getting your limit every time, they don't factor that in. So that's when you start getting a drop in like limits and stuff like that, because they have to factor in more efficient.
Yeah, and I think we may have started. You can't really point to one specific thing, because there was a lot. You know, last year wasn't a typical year. We didn't get a lot of rain and stuff in the winter, so the lake was really low. But we did not catch as many fish last year as we had in previous years. I mean, in the previous probably 3 years before last, so going back to 4 years ago, we were going on the weekend and catching, you know, a 3 and 4 man limit, no problem. You know, two fish per person. And last year, I don't think we ever caught our full limit once last year. So, I mean, it was kind of an off year, and the weather was, we stayed colder longer, the water didn't warm up. So, and that's kind of what their spawning period goes off of, is the water temperature and everything. So the water temperature stayed colder for longer. So that may have been a part of it too, but I you have to wonder if that, you know, affects the population of the fish. Of course, the Missouri Department of Conservation is stocking those lakes and reservoirs every year with fish. Yeah. But those fish take a lot longer to get to. So they have to be 34 inches. So they have to be 34 inches long to be able to keep a paddlefish. So, and it takes, I used to know this off the top of my head on how long it took a fish to get, I want to say it's somewhere in the 5-year range. Like it takes them 5 years to get that big, something like that. So, you know, it's not a fish that's replenishing itself and, you know, instantly. It's not like a catfish or a bass or anything like that where they grow rapidly. It takes several years for them to get the size that they are.
Yeah. Have you seen a paddlefish, like a skull, when it's been European mounted, like
yeah.
beetles?
Yeah, there's
those things are wild.
Yeah, still, they're pretty cool. So they're not like it. They're all what are they called? They're like a shark. So they have no bones in them. All they have is that cord, like the spinal cord. That's like a. I mean, if you pull it out, it's like a squishy rope. Like you can sit there and squish it together, mm-hmm. almost. And I. So it's pretty cool. There's a guy that does that around here. He posts in the Missouri paddlefish groups several times during the season, you know, asking for people's business and whatnot and post pictures of them. And yeah, it's pretty cool. It'd be something interesting that you can, you know, add to your taxidermy wall per se. So
yeah, there's on Fort Peck, they have the museum, like with dinosaurs and stuff they found around there, and then a bunch of different species of the fish that they have. Anyways, they got a couple of those European mounted paddlefish skulls, and every time that we go there, it's just crazy looking at it. All the, like the paddle itself, it's just insane looking.
Yeah.
Like a spider web, little bones and cartilage. I guess not bones, but cartilage.
Yeah, cartilage is what it is. But yeah, they're pretty cool looking. So do you all? How do you cook your paddlefish? Do you just fry it like you do regular fish, or how are you making it?
We never kept one to eat it.
Oh, you don't keep them.
You can, but I mean, we don't. Cause usually, don't. We're out there just having a good time and just doing it. So I've never even had it.
Oh,
so I
don't know. Yeah, that's it's actually pretty good table fare. You know, it's
is it like
it's
firm not, at all, like pike and walleye, or is it squishy like bass?
It's,
or what's it like?
It's squishy. Yeah, it's squishy, and it's hard to get the fishiness out of it. You know, like the you know just kind of got that fishy taste to it. Even if you cut, so they have a lot of. They have a lot of red meat on them, like a catfish would, or you know, like any larger fish would. And if you get all the red meat out of it, you know, you still got that hint of like, you know, just kind of, I don't even know how you would describe it, you know, just fishy type flavor in it. And it's hard to get that really out of it. You know, opposed to like a, you know, a crappie or panfish or something like that. So
are you guys keeping the eggs?
No. So you're allowed to keep, I forget how many ounces. It's like you can keep so many ounces for personal use, like personal consumption, but, we get rid of them. So there was a big operation here a few years ago. They called it Operation Roadhouse. Where they arrested a bunch of Russians that were trafficking paddlefish eggs out of Missouri. So they were, you know, they would go and get the paddlefish eggs off of, you know, they'd just go to like the local boat ramp and, you know, quote unquote, buy fish off of people or, you know, whatever, or they'd go catch them themselves and traffic the eggs. But it was a pretty big deal here. They arrested several people over it. And it's a big deal here that if you get caught with those, if you get caught more than what you're supposed to with those eggs, it could get you in some pretty hot water pretty quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, no, it's a big, so they've started doing tournaments and stuff on the Lake of the Ozarks as well, snagging tournaments where there's like, there's one that, for first place, you know, if you catch the biggest fish and get first place, you're winning 10 grand, which is just absolutely bizarre to me. So,
yeah, that's each their own. That'd be, I mean, that's a long day doing that just to I guess it'd be the same thing as us doing the Coyote Derby. It's all kind of a, I mean, you don't, it's like a gamble.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's 100% a gamble.
Lose a lot if you don't.
Yeah. You're relying a lot on skill and whatnot, but you're also relying on a lot of luck too. I mean, you gotta be able to find that big fish. Cause my brother and I had participated in a couple of those. They have one called the Snag Masters every year. And, you know, a couple years into it, we tried our hand at it. And I think the biggest fish we ended up turning in that day was like 54 pounds or something like that. But the biggest was like 90 or something. So we're like 40 pounds off the lead. But it changes the whole atmosphere of the day. Cause you're like, man, we really need to catch a big fish. Cause you want to do good. You don't want to show up with no fish to weigh or, a small fish to weigh. So it just kind of changes the whole persona and doesn't make it as fun in my opinion. So we just kind of got away from that.
I gotcha. So I want to ask you real quick, do you guys get swans down there in Missouri? Do they migrate through you guys?
Yes, we do. So the numbers have actually been picking up over the last several years. We get a lot of swans down here, but we cannot hunt them. They're not tundra swans, they're trumpeter swans.
Oh, okay. So you guys don't get the tundra.
Yeah, we don't get the tundras down here. So we get to watch a lot of them. So there's a lake here that we goose hunt quite a bit, and there's always several of them that sit on that lake. And then you can see them, about every cornfield around seems like it has a couple of two or three in them, or you'll find a big group of them, 50 to 60 birds. So
you guys spotted any net callers on them? I know a lot of them are.
Yes. So there was one. There was one right up the road from where I live last year. I think my brother was telling me about that they had saw. And then I had a gentleman on Rawls in one of the first one of my first episodes. He has a guiding business. Just north of here, about an hour and a half, and they have one that comes in every year on their place that they watch every year, and they get to they get to report it every year whenever it comes in. So
that's awesome. That's really cool.
But you guys can hunt swans where you're at, right?
Yep, we get the tundras, and we get a tag every year, and we go. I think last year was the only year I didn't shoot one, and that's just because the way the migration went and the weather, they came in and they were gone like within a week. Normally they stick around for a couple weeks, so you got time to find them and get after them, but this year we didn't get a chance.
Yeah, that seemed to be the case with a lot of birds. I mean, our population of ducks and geese this year kind of came and gone really quick. There was good numbers for a few weeks, and then the cold, we got real cold real fast, and it pushed a bunch of birds out, pushed the ducks out, pushed the geese in. But it just seemed like it didn't last very long this year. So
yeah, I mean, that's kind of in it, the way that we had a kid right at the end of September, our third kid, so it really, really kind of put a damper on my waterfowl season.
Yeah.
The way they migrated through and the way the weather went. We had the kid, and then, I didn't really want to get away from home, help take care of the other two. And then we kind of got weather, birds were here, and then they were gone by the time, she was old enough that I could get away and do stuff. So
yeah,
just kind of a wash of the season.
Yeah, that's why you gotta plan that stuff out, kind of. I always joke with my wife, I'm like, both of our kids, so my son was born in June and daughter was born in July, and I always joke with her that I kind of planned it because I didn't want to have a kid right before or during hunting season to interrupt hunting season. So that's kind of the running joke around our house, is that we always plan our kids around hunting season.
Well, that's what it was for the first two. They were both born in February, so that's nice and easy. Nothing going on then but ice fishing. The third one, he didn't quite stick to the script.
Kind of snuck in there on you, huh?
Yeah, they do that. They do that a lot.
Yep, definitely. So how old are your kids?
My son is 4, and then my one daughter is 2, and then the third or second daughter is, she was born at the end of September, so I guess how many months that is.
A few months old. So you're both of your kids are the same age as, basically the same age as mine, because my daughter's 4, she'll be 5 in July, and then my son will be 2 in June. So
yeah, trying to have the fun age with a 4-year-old, but he likes to go along and do stuff. Like doing turkey scouting last week, he was all about it. I mean, the only issue we had was he can't quite hold his bathroom stuff as long as an adult, so we'll be having fun, then all of a sudden he'll look at you and give you that, uh-oh, I gotta go now. So other than that, it's fun.
Yeah, I've kind of started, getting my daughter into stuff a little bit. I'll take her when I go scouting and stuff for geese. I'll say like, hey, let's go look at the geese. She's like, okay. Mm-hmm. We go get in the truck and go drive around and find some geese or whatnot. Or if I pick her up from school in the afternoons from preschool, and I'll just say, hey, let's go for a ride. Let's go see if we can find some geese. And she sits there and she watches, I'll watch hunting on YouTube and stuff like that. And she kind of sits there and watches it with me sometimes. So I'm trying to pique her interest in it a little bit and try to start maybe next year, maybe taking her, on some warm days, if we catch a warm day where she can get out there and enjoy it, just kind of see, get a feel for it, see if she likes it. So
my son ate up with it, I mean, he was along. Well, I took him archery hunting for antelope a couple times. We did a couple stalks, and then when I shot my antelope with my rifle, he was there next to me. And he's seen me shoot quite a few birds. Like when we go upland hunting, I just put his earphones on him, and then he's got his BB gun, and he just walks next to me. It's just me and him. I go with him with other people. And we just kind of go along with the dog, do his thing. If we pick up and shoot a bird, I'll shoot it, and then he gets mad at me because I didn't give him time to shoot it.
Yeah.
As long as he's got his earphones on, we're good. That's just the only thing I'm worried about. I don't want him to get scared of the noise or hurt his ear.
Yeah, and that's what I'll have to get my daughter a set of earphones, because she does not like loud noises. Like we'll go to like a basketball game or places like that, and she just doesn't care for the loud noises. So I will have to kind of be aware of that. You don't want to scare them, away from it by any means. So
yeah, kind of funny story on the antelope with the bow. I had him along, and we spotted this herd of antelope out in, it was a hay pasture, so they had bales of hay lined up on it, and there was a herd of antelope. It was a really, really good buck, and then he had like nine or ten does, and it was on that hay field, was a state land. So we park, and they were about 600 yards from the road, and the hay bales were about 500 yards from the road. And the way that they were set up where we parked, we could walk all the way up to the hay bales, and they're between us and the antelopes. And it was just me and him. We walked all the way out there to those bales, and I had my longbow. So that's why I switched over to traditional archery this last year, because I promised my grandpa I would shoot something with his bow he made before he passed away. So that's what I'm trying to do. So all I have now is my longbow. So anyways, that kind of plays into it. So we got up to these hay bales, and the sun was covered by clouds, so it was kind of chilly. So we got all the way out to those bales, and I peeked around the bales, and they had fed closer to them, so they were like 60 yards. I'm like, they're feeding towards us, so you got to be really quiet, really quiet. Okay. And we sat there for about 5 minutes, and I looked over, and he's just shivering. He had a sweatshirt on, but he didn't have a coat, and it was just cold enough for him that he was shivering. I was hot, but he was cold. Yeah. I'm like, you okay, bud? Do I need to get your coat? I need my coat. I was like, all right, well, I'm not going to carry you all the way back to pickup to carry you out here. So you stay right here, touch this hay bale. I'll be right back. So I sprinted all the way back to pickup, grabbed his coat, ran all the way back, put the coat on him. We sat there, and the antelope had kind of fed away, but they were starting to feed back. So anyways, they kind of were doing that, going back and forth, and they went to the other side of this bales. So we crept all the way around to the other side of the bales, and we were sitting against the other corner. And they were, at this point, like 40 yards away, and like 30 yards of my max range of the longbow, like absolute max. I'm like, they keep coming this way, I'm going to get a shot. So it's like, you got to be really quiet, buddy. They're right there. He's like, okay, dad, there's ants, dad, there's ants. It's like, yeah, buddy, they're ants. Okay. Dad, there's other bugs. Yeah, buddy, okay. You got to be quiet. Okay. Pinky promised to be quiet. Okay, be quiet. And then it was like 2 seconds later, and I just kind of hear a drone up in the sky. Like, I can hear a noise. I'm like, oh, shit, there's an airplane. and he never misses an airplane. Airplane goes over. Dad, an airplane! It yells as loud as he possibly could. Like, oh, gosh, I see the plane. I look over the, whatever. For some reason, the antelope didn't hear us. I don't know how, but yeah, airplane went by, and he's a lot louder than I am by myself. But yeah, he just screamed as loud as he could. The airplane! The antelope never ended up feeding closer than like 35 yards, so we didn't get one that day. But I mean, we sat out there for like 3 hours and watched antelope and planes and bugs and had a great time.
So. Yeah, I'm excited to get my daughter out there. I'm ready for those to start kind of making those type of memories and have those type of stories to tell. So I know I'm pretty fond of, you know, the kind of the first couple of times that I went hunting with my dad, and I kind of remember those and quote unquote cherish those memories a bunch. So I'm ready to start making those with my kids. And you know, I like, don't get me wrong, I will always say this, I love pulling the trigger on things, but I can't wait to get them behind the gun or the bow and see how they do.
Yeah, it's a game changer. Like I said, it's a lot different when you're by yourself. I prefer, like, when I'm archery hunting, be by myself, because I know if something messes up, it's my fault. I don't have to worry about anything else. But I mean, I love just much having him along, even if it doesn't work out, just to get to see him experiencing the world. Because, like, I don't know the bugs anymore when I'm walking along. He'll be walking along and pointing out bugs or pointing out tracks and pile of deer poop. He loves seeing deer poop. He spots that right away, and he'll make sure that I know that it's there, stuff like that. But it's really cool. I like it a lot.
Yeah. So I just lost my train of thought. I'm not even going to lie. I'm not even trying to hide that. So give me, I'm going to start a new segment on my podcast here. And I'm not sure exactly what I want to call it yet, but give me one of your favorite memories from the outdoors, you know, whether it's, you know, an animal you killed or some time you spent with somebody. I just want to start kind of getting everybody's, I'd like to hear everybody's favorite memory of being in the outdoors.
Man, I've got so many.
It's hard to pick, isn't it?
Yeah. All the ones with him are special in their own way. Like, because, I mean, obviously you get to see my kid enjoy it, but I mean, that's just kind of like a cop out answer. You know, I could say my first year with my dad, but I wouldn't say that's my best memory, just because we've had so many more besides that. I want to say the one that, I mean, like, I got screwed up ones, like, they're funny stories, but I guess, like, the best memory, the most excited I ever was when I shot my first buck with a bow, because for some reason I just had the yips when it came to bucks. I had shot like 3 dozen does with my bow, but whenever it came to a buck, something always came up and something went wrong, or I totally got target panic and flinched. But when the first one that I actually got finally came together, I was working for a farmer, and we had a rain day, and we had been farming next to this like abandoned farmyard or tree roads, and we're out here on the prairie. We don't have trees, so I don't get a tree stand hunt or ground blind hunt. But we were next to this tree row, and whenever I was like, I had went out and disc that field, and I had rolled that field. I planted that field of peas and rolled it. I'd been around that tree row a bunch, and every time I went by it, there's always deer in it. And so I knew it was a good spot, and I asked the guy that actually owned it, because we were leasing land or whatever. I asked him if I could set up a ground blind in that tree row and hunt it if we ever got free time, and he said, go for it. So I went in there in, like, August, and I found a good spot where, like, all these trails kind of combined, and I set up my ground blind, like, 30 yards away from it, and I really wasn't expecting to go out. Anyways, we had got a really big rainstorm, so me and my wife went out. She was my girlfriend at the time, and she was pregnant with her son. Me and her went out on, I think it was a Friday, and we sat in there, didn't see nothing, and it was nothing. She kind of took a nap, and that was it. And then the next day, it was still wet in the morning, so I asked him if I could take the morning off to go hunting, and he said, go for it, we're not going to do much anyway. So I went out there, and I sat in the blind, sat in there, and nothing was happening, and it was like the middle of the day. I was about to pack up, and all of a sudden, this doe and a fawn come in out of nowhere, just like across the field. They just popped up like out of nowhere, like they came out of the ground, and walked right into the tree row, like right at me. and I mean, they went by it like 10 yards, perfect, didn't know I was there, so I got excited. It's like, okay, another 30 minutes, you know, like you do. And I thought, if another one, like if a buck comes through like that, it's perfect. And this is like September-ish, end of September, it's still archery season. And so, you know, bucks aren't chasing does or anything then. But something happened, I don't know if someone was farming or somebody was bird hunting or what, but all of a sudden I just like hear like a stampede and I look up and here comes like 12 does running straight at that tree row, and behind them I can see antlers. And so all these does come filing through this tree row, and they come filing through, and I kind of lost the buck in all the confusion looking through the trees, and all of a sudden he was right there at like 10 yards and he kept on walking. Well, I had taken off my release when I thought I was going to go, and I totally forgot about it. So he's like at 10 yards, so I went to go clip on my release. My release wasn't on my wrist. It's like, oh, shit. So I had to dig around my bag, find my release, put it on, get it on my bow. And by the time that happened, he was like 30 yards away, like quartering away. And he was just standing there. So I had to turn in that blind. And like I was telling you before the show, this blind is small, and I got a long draw length. So when I draw, I have to draw back and put my back elbow out the back window, and the front of my bow pretty much touches the front of the blind. And so I go back and I miss the window with my elbow, so I'm sliding around on that material, making that sound. Finally find the window and I get drawn back all the way, my elbow pops out, and he's still there at like 30 yards, like a light quartering away, mostly broadside. And I don't know what happened, because like I said, I get such target panic whenever it was a buck, like buck fever. But for some reason, when I drew back, my pins are locked on him right on. I was like, holy shit, this is going to happen. Like, I can't miss this. All my pins are covering this thing. All I have to do is touch the trigger. And I don't remember putting my finger on the trigger or anything. All of a sudden, the bow just went off. And I watched that arrow. I had a Luminoc. And I watched that green knot go, 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 go. And then all of a sudden, it just disappeared on him. And I had missed so many bucks. I was like, I shot under him again. I had to have shot under again. And then he did, like, the perfect hunting video mule kick. Did that big old mule kick. And I saw the arrow go flip out of his other side. And he took off running, went like 40 yards and flipped over, and then he got up and kept on running again. And then instantly had an adrenaline dump. And it was like the craziest feeling, like my heart was going. I didn't know what was going on. I was freaking out. And I was in a place with like no service. And so, you know, the first thing I did was I called my dad. I called him. He could barely hear me, but I was like yelling and freaking out. And I was like, he was breaking up bad, but he just kept saying, I can't hear you. What's going on? Are you hurt? Like he thought I was hurt, and then the call dropped. So, and I had forgot about that, so I called one of my friends right away to let him know, because I told him if I ever got with my bow, to let him know and you come out and help me find it. And he could barely hear me, too. Well, in the meantime, my dad's freaking out because he thought I got hurt because I was screaming on the phone. He couldn't hear me. And then the call dropped, and then he's trying to call me back. I was on the phone with someone else. And so anyways, long story short, I mean, that was a great, great moment. My friend, another guy, came up. We tracked him, found him, like another 80 yards past that, another little tree row. Somehow, in the middle of it, I had took off my release again, and I dropped it somewhere, and I looked and looked and looked for the next 3 days, and never went by there.
Couldn't find it.
Never did find the release, but yeah, I mean, it was kind of like you had to be there. I tried to explain it the best I can, but just like the feeling that I got after 10 years of missing or screwing it up or it just not coming together to finally get a buck with my bow, it was like the greatest hunting feeling I've ever experience. So that's my most, I guess, memorable hunting story.
Okay. Yeah, I've got an interesting first buck with a bow story as well that I'll share. I haven't shared on here. So I was probably, I think I was old enough to drive, so I think I was at least six. I was probably 16 years old. I was probably a junior in high school, something like that. Been bow hunting for a few years, hadn't killed my first deer with a bow yet. And it was one of the first times I'd went that year. It was kind of late October, and first time I'd been in that stand. So I climb up in the stand and just kind of looking around, and I noticed I climb up the ladder and I sit down on the platform, and I noticed something's a little, you know, it's a little moves a little too much. And I'm like, that's not good. So I kind of look over my shoulder, and I see the strap is hanging. Like, instead of going around the tree, it's hanging.
So you're just leaning on the tree.
So I'm just,
you're not strapped in.
Yeah, I'm not strapped to the tree at all. And I'm just leaning against the tree. And I'm like, well, I'm here. I might as well just ride this out and we'll see how it goes. So I hadn't been in the stand 10 minutes. The sun, sun's starting to come up, and I see this deer walking through the woods to me, walking down the path. And I'm like, oh, that's a buck. I'm like, oh, that's a shooter. I can shoot that one. And so he comes, he follows this trail around. He walks in front of me and walks, because I was going to have to be kind of picky on where I shot, because I couldn't move. I'm stuck where I'm stuck at. So I wait till he kind of gets over on my left side, and I draw my bow back, and he's broadside probably 20 yards, and I just, boom, let the arrow fly, and that deer just drops. I shot him in the spine, and he just dropped right there. So then, of course, then he's like trying to like paw away. So of course I knock another arrow, whack. And he's still just trying to get away. So I knock another. I put three arrows in this deer. And finally, there was a creek bank right there. And finally, he just like rolled down the creek bank where I couldn't see him anymore. And my dad wasn't hunting far from where I was at. He was probably 150 yards up, kind of north of me a little ways. And he's like, all I heard was commotion. And I heard thwack. And I just heard a bunch of rustling in the leaves, and I didn't know what was going on, because I called him. I was like, Dad, I got one. And he's like, all right, well, I'll be down there in a minute. And so I after I had shot the deer, I'm like, how am I going to get out of here without falling out of this stand? So I hooked my bow to the string, and I let it down. And I very gingerly, climbed down the ladder, and I made it down without falling out of that tree stand. But yeah, that was a added twist to the first deer I killed with a bow. It was scared the hell out of me when I seen that strap hanging there by the tree, and it wasn't attached to the tree.
So. My grandparents, well, my family's originally from South Dakota, and they're in the northeast corner where there's a lot more trees and draws, and they have land. And so they've got draw trees in them next to the house that, I mean, my grandpa hunted growing up, my dad hunted growing up, all my uncles hunted growing up. So there's old stands all over in there, and a lot of them are old homemade ones, because this is before, like, they made stands you go buy at Fleet Farm or whatever.
Yeah.
So when I was a kid, I was walking the draw one time, I was deer hunting. This would have been when it would have been right at the end of high school. And so anyways, I was going to just kind of find a tree to lean up against. It was just kind of a thing. We were there for a day or two visiting family, it was during hunting season. So I was just going to lean up against this tree. Well, I found an old homemade stand where it was like 2x4s nailed into the tree going up as the ladder.
Yeah.
And then it was pretty much like a platform between, two limbs on the tree or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I climb all the way up to every single one of those ladder steps, twisted as you went up, because the nails have been 1973 or whatever.
But yeah,
I made it up to the top, and I'm standing there, I'm holding my bow, and I hear something, so I go kind of step over a little bit, look around the tree, and the board I step on completely falls out from under it, and somehow I catch myself and pull myself back, so now there's only three boards between these two limbs holding me up, and I'm an idiot. And so I was like, well, I guess I won't step there again. So then I was standing there on the two boards, and it was kind of windy. So every time that tree moved, every one of those nails that were holding that little platform in would go, and then went back and forth, and you could feel it swaying. I can't believe I didn't fall out of there, or that thing didn't give out on me, but didn't get anything that day. But yeah, then being up there in a tree on something sketchy, now that I think back about it, that's so dumb.
Oh yeah.
Memories.
And I hunted, growing up, I hunted out of a lot of those homemade built, my dad and his friend that we hunted on, they built these stands, and they were very well built. They're probably 15, 20. I can't even remember how tall they were. Looking back at them, it was probably 15, 20 feet in the air, something like that. And they built big platforms with railings around, railing around them. And you go up and sit on a 5-gallon bucket. But then I've also, my grandpa, God bless his heart, he he had a deer stand that he had built, and it was in these, it was in just a set of four trees, like these four trees had just grown together and kind of grew up. And of course, my grandpa didn't like to get very high off the ground. So this, I mean, now standing up, I could probably, you know, looking back now, if I, you know, if I stood up and stuck my hand up in the air, which is probably about 8 foot or whatever, you know, 8.5 foot, I could probably touch the touch the platform in the tree. And of course he had this, so he had this platform in these four trees. And then sticking out, he had kind of a, he had another platform going out that he would stick us grandkids. He would stick us grandkids out there on the front platform. Cause you know, he didn't care nothing about shooting deer really. You know, he was just there to take us and let us shoot deer or whatever. And, I still look back at the, at that stand and I'm like, man, that, I don't know how that stand lasted all those years with all of us kids in there. And, you know, that was, that, that's some of my favorite memories too, is hunting out of that stand. You know, I killed several deer out of there with my grandpa, and, he doesn't really hunt anymore. Those are some pretty cool, memories that I like to, I always like to share with everybody. Cause going with, I don't know about you, but I know always going with my dad, dad was always like, shh, be quiet. Hey, no, but don't step on that stick. Don't, you know, dad was always like the strictest, like, don't say nothing. You know, we're going to sit here and be quiet the whole time. Grandpa, he's pulling out the Ziploc full of snacks out of his coat and he's rustling stuff around. He's like, you want a candy bar? You know, you want to do this or whatever? And, it was always a good time. So,
yeah. My grandpa is the same way as yours with the stand height, but opposite in the quiet thing. I mean, you could tell which stands were my grandpa's, even when we had ladder stands, because they would, you just like take like the first section and put up. He'd be like 6 foot up in the air.
Yeah.
As long as you're up above them, they don't care. But I mean, he, on the quiet thing, he would, we'd be rolling in his big blue 1993 Chevy 3/4 ton with a 454 big block with no muffler left on it, so just louder
just shit. Loud as hell.
But we'd be in there with the radio off, and if one of us grandkids talked to us, shh, they're gonna hear you, shh, the whole way, even in that pickup.
I don't really deer hunt anymore. I just kind of, once I got into waterfowl hunting, I really just kind of got out of it. You know, I don't do it as much. But some of my fondest memories growing up, you know, all of my memories growing up, I've only been duck hunting, waterfowl hunting for about 10 years now. So all of my memories growing up either came from deer hunting or turkey hunting. Which turkey hunting is a whole nother subject on my part. Turkeys and I have a interesting relationship. You know, I love turkey hunting. It's my second favorite thing to do behind waterfowl hunting. But I get so excited. I get so worked up that I cost myself birds over it. Like I butcher the shots, or I just missed, you know, and I've missed several easy shots just because I get so worked up, and it's something that I've been working on, I guess I will say. And my brother always likes to tease me about it. You know, he's always, you know, I think he made a joke on the last podcast. He's like, I'm going to take you target practicing before we go turkey hunting this year. I'm like, I don't need target practice. I can shoot fine. I get so worked up that I just always do something at the last second to cost myself, you know, cost myself a bird. You know, I don't think things through, or I'm not, you know, I just act instead of thinking through the situation per se.
Well, that's the reptilian brain trying to take over.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's, but we're coming up on turkey season, and you're going to try your hand at it this spring, aren't you?
Yep. First time actually trying to hunt them, not just to walk down the draw and shoot one as it goes running by. So we did that a couple times growing up. But, yeah, this year I'm going to actually put in the work, and I'm going to try to get one with my bow. I just went and bought a big ground blind today at Portland's Warehouse. So we're going to We're going to see if I can do it. I'm trying to figure out the old diaphragm turkey call, and it's something, but we'll see. Hopefully we get one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's it'll be another addiction to throw under your belt, you know. It's one of those things.
I got spring snow goose season, too, that I got to worry about. So now if I throw two things in the spring, I don't know if my wife's going to like me as much as she used to.
Yeah, there's always that too. You got to keep the spouse happy. So, yeah. But well, I know it is Saturday, so I won't keep you much longer. We've been going at it for a little under an hour now, but I appreciate you coming on with me today and spending some time with me and telling some stories.
For sure.
So for those of you that don't know, Garrett also hosts a podcast called The Wicked Hunting Report. Garrett, why don't you tell them how to find you so they can get over and listen to your podcast as well?
Yeah, so anywhere that you listen to podcasts, you should be able to find it. It's just called Wicked Hunting Report. If you're looking for it and you don't see it on your platform, let me know and I'll get it on that. And then there's a Facebook page, and then there's also the Instagram is Wicked Hunting Report Podcast. We're actually doing a hunt giveaway on there right now that I guess it'll be done by the time this airs, so don't worry about that. But yeah, so go find us on the Instagram and follow the show. And then I guess also I train dogs in my spare time, so I've got a page on Facebook for that too. It's Highline Retrievers, HILINE Retrievers. Yeah, so if you want to check out dog stuff or hunting stuff, those are the two pages to look for.
Okay. Yeah, everybody get out there, give Garrett a listen, like his social media, and as always, thank you everybody for tuning in to another episode of the Final Descend podcast. If you're not, like us and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. That's where you can keep up with show updates, new episode alerts, and all that good stuff, and listen to us anywhere you listen to your podcast. Thank you again, and we'll see you next time.